I told you not to drink from there. I hope you stayed here like I told you. Listen, they didn't attack for no reason. Somebody is controlling them. We have to stop whoever's behind all this madness. From now on, don't listen to what anybody else says, okay? Just do as I tell you to do. Promise me.
Don't I always do what you tell me to do? I think we should hurry up and try to get help before we do anything else.
It's coming after us. We can't be safe here. Come on. Let's go.
High culture means high technology at the bleeding edge of the radical right. Majority Rights Radio.
I have with me Dr. Tomislav Sunik, who is the author of one book he wrote in 1990, Against Democracy and Equality, the European New Right, and it has recently been reissued, I believe. And he is also the author of a book which is about to come out, and he'll be talking to us about that. Hello, Dr. Sunik.
Hello, how are you doing? Thanks for inviting me.
Now, I'm ashamed to admit that I was not completely aware of your background and your books before I was assigned to do this interview. And I'm looking at your curriculum vitae, and you've had really an amazing life. You were born in Croatia in 1953. You're a dual citizen of Croatia and the United States.
Correct.
You have bachelor's degrees in English and literature, and also another one in French literature, and master's in international affairs and a doctorate in political science from the University of California.
Mm-hmm.
You've worked in Algeria, in the U.S., in Croatia.
Yeah, I forgot to mention one thing. I was also a hippie back in 1971. I went to Kathmandu, and I was hitchhiking all the way to Goa and Kashmir and then to Bombay.
Oh, really?
I was a dropout. I grew up with the Grateful Dead, in a way, back in the late... I was then, believe it or not, I was 18, and I went all by myself. I didn't have any money, and I went all the way down to India hitchhiking. It was my way of sort of resisting the communist uglification in communist, ex-communist Yugoslavia.
Really? Can you tell me a little bit more about what that was like growing up behind the Iron Curtain, as it were?
Well, just to put it briefly, ex-communist Yugoslavia was to some extent different from other ex-communist countries in Eastern Europe, in the sense that it was quote-unquote more liberal. It allowed its citizens to travel, but in terms of its criminal code, yes, precise. But in terms of its repression, in terms of its wooden language, in terms of its mendacity, it was pretty much the same. So it wasn't certainly that much different. However, it did allow many Croats and it did allow many citizens to leave the country and go in other places to work and simply to relocate to different countries in the Western Europe.
Hmm. So you hitchhiked to Goa. Wow.
Yes. That was my way, in a sense, to well, I certainly didn't read very much back then. In fact, I did read Hermann Hesse. I read William Burroughs. I read some Jack Kerouac. Of course, I grew up with Jack Kerouac.
Journey to the East.
Exactly, and then, but that was my way of resisting back then this communist graphics, if I can put it that way. I, of course, back then I couldn't protest, I couldn't write well, and so on. But I just need to drop out because I just couldn't put up, and I couldn't stand this communist uglification. And plus,
and at the time, did you like the West? You liked the West better at the time. You didn't when you were 18. You didn't see that liberalism and communism are two faces of very much the same beast.
Absolutely, and to be quite frank with you and perfectly honest with you, sir, I guess I was more of an American than you are, in a sense that I projected...
I don't doubt that.
I truly loved America back then because we did all expect, in a sense, I was a sort of a right-wing hippie, if you wish, and I always quarreled with those lefties, the left-leaning hippies. And in fact, we all applauded, my family applauded, you know, the bombardment of Vietnam. And I was raised in a very conservative family. So we did sort of a subconsciously, this was the only way of opposition back in communist countries, back in the 60s, 70s, in my formative years, so to speak. So we could only formulate our anti-communist views intramuros, within four walls, or possibly going to the church, not necessarily to pray, but to crack jokes with fellow citizens who shared more or less the same sensibility. And for me, in my that particular stage of my life, of course, I listened to Frank Zappa, Grateful Dead, and I was also raving and ranting about ugly communists, bad communists, and for me, America was just about everything.
And how has your thinking on that evolved?
Pretty much so. I guess I can. I guess it may probably sound a little bit too pretentious for some of your listeners later on. I always like putting myself in perspective, meaning I often put myself, even when I talk to just passersby down there, down in the street, I talk to them. I always try to empathize with them, both positively and negatively, meaning I'm trying to view myself also with the eyes of my foe or with the eyes of my enemy. Not necessarily with somebody who likes me. I don't know if you can follow me on that. In other words, the same thing happened with me when I came to the United States. Like most dissidents, I'm sure you're familiar with Solzhenitsyn, Bukovsky, Zinoviev, and who are truly outstanding dissidents, in a sense that there were also dissidents against both systems. But most East European so-called anti-communist dissidents who came from Czechia, Czechoslovakia back then, and Romania, abandoned this communist mendacity, and they wholeheartedly embraced, without any criticism, without any second thoughts, this quote-unquote capitalist, never-ending, infinite justice and democracy. I think this is a wrong way of judging things in this dual fashion, not just from the academic perspective, but also from a moral perspective. If a person is truly a dissident, or let me put it in a past tense, if a person was truly a dissident, as I was in my entire family, don't forget my dad, who was a lawyer, Catholic lawyer, he went twice to prison, excuse me, in ex-communist Yugoslavia, excuse me, I think that the person needs also to be consistent with his nature and with his integrity, meaning that no matter what the system he chooses as an alternative, he has to be critical towards it.
Right.
I guess I made myself clear, it's somewhat philosophical, but basically what I'm trying to say, I may dislike certain things about communism. I hate many things about communism. But it doesn't mean in any way whatsoever that I must wholeheartedly accept this religion of free market, or for that matter, embrace every nook and cranny of conservatism.
No, and as we'll see in our discussion, we'll talk about this, conservatism or right-wing thought plays out pretty differently in America and Europe, actually, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about, because there's nothing in America that corresponds to the new right.
Right.
Or very little. Anyway, just to go back and talk about you for a second, you're fluent in English, Croatian, French, and German. You can read Italian fluently, and you can read some Latin.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's very impressive.
Well, it's just a matter of hard work. You know, some folks like cars and driving around and having fun and getting high or whatever. I mean, I tried many of those things.
I imagine.
Oh, you bet. But I sort of brag myself. I know the leftist mentality very well, and I know my enemies, if I can put it to somewhat generic fashion, very well. But there are certain values, and I wouldn't like to, you know, brag about this, and I just like to keep it private. There are certain spiritual values which I cherish very much and which are extremely dear to me, and I guess they transcend this human passing existence.
You and I discussed this interview before we conducted it, and as you know, I had the following in mind. I have some questions that the readers of Majority Rights have submitted. I've selected some of those, and I want to ask you those first, because I think once we get into our discussion of the issues that we've set aside, that we'll probably get lost in that, and we wouldn't come back to the submitted questions. So may I start with those?
Please.
How well does the new European New Right have an understanding of biological race? Do you think they perhaps stress culture over race too much?
It's a good question indeed, and I cannot give you a straightforward answer, because even among rank and file, if you wish, of New Right thinkers and authors in Europe, there is a great deal of friendly debating as to whether culture, in a generic sense, should precede other approaches regarding the human drama, if we can put it that way, or whether we should just stick to biological determinism. Now, let me just warn you about one little thing. Alain de Benoist, whom I know well, is my friend and is a mentor, if you wish. He's rejecting any determinism, be it a socialist, Marxist, economic determinism, or for that matter, even biological determinism. And you really got me here on this spot, because I myself, I think I may probably be slightly more inclined towards this biological determinism. After all, I'm not just a tabula rasa. I guess I must have inherited 60% or 70% of genes from my mom and my former mother and my dad. So yes, I cannot give you a specific answer on that, but one thing for sure is that the New Right in Europe, at least, is much more flowery, if I can put it that way. It goes across the board. It certainly has much more of a Renaissance erudition than American New Right proponents.
All right. Do you consider Putin a nationalist in the sense of really caring about the survival of ethnic Russia? Or is Putin really just a statist concerned with a strong Russia, and even if that Russia ends up with a majority non-Russian population?
Well, he's certainly... let me first... I'm sorry, sir, but I think we need to clarify some concepts. Like nationalism, even in Europe, in French, it has a somewhat different connotation than in English. And by and large, this word nationalism nowadays in Europe has a slightly pejorative meaning that something like reactionary, something bad, something which is not politically correct, we can put it that way. Now, specifically as Putin himself is concerned, he is certainly not a traditional nationalist, probably the way we are, or probably some of our colleagues and friends in the States, or for that matter in Germany are. But he is certainly much more concerned with the nativist politics of Russia and its survival than some of his colleagues in the Western Europe.
Okay, thank you. My next question comes from a friend of yours and mine, a guest worker.
Yes.
And he writes that he is interested in your vision of the Promethean in European man. He says that you propose it as a characterization of the best and most creative in us. Do you see in this notion of the Promethean a stronger sense? Do you see it as a place to seek a genuine corrective to the spiritual dependency and self-doubt that inhabits the Christian faith, or even the basis for a full replacement of the Christian faith? Going further, do you regard Christianity as so alien and, through its inherent universalism, so bound now to the modern liberal zeitgeist that its slothing, I think he means sloughing, is a precondition for our freedom? In that event, do you recognize that the call to faith will remain irresistible for many and must be answered?
It's a very good question, but I guess we have to divvy it up a little bit, if you do not mind. I certainly do have doubts, and this is probably the hallmark, if we can put it that way, of true intellectual Prometheism, that the person must constantly put himself into question. He must examine and re-examine, and as I use the word, putting himself in perspective. I definitely, and I hope I'm not going to insult some of your listeners and some of your readers for that matter, I think that Prometheism is incompatible with monotheistic spirit. In other words, it cannot match well with Judeo-Christian heritage.
Was it Ernst Jünger a Promethean?
Yes.
In your opinion?
By all means. Yes. We don't use the word for him because it has a somewhat literary meaning. Yeah, exactly. He was a Promethean person. And I use it as a figure of speech. Not necessarily for somebody who is, but also for somebody who should become. Europe nowadays is definitely un-Promethean. I should say almost anti-Promethean.
Right.
It is much more obsessed with its, Now it's dictatorship of good being, of well-being, of good looks, of hedonism, you name it. I mean, there are millions of words we can choose. But it's certainly not any longer as was the case, not just in during the Greeks, the old Greeks, but also during the Renaissance and even until recently. When people like to transcend themselves, when they look for some other values than just perishable commodities, this is, in a simple language, in a simple English lingo, this means Prometheanism.
Okay. The next question is rather long, and I encourage you to answer it quickly.
You better.
But it's a long question. The new right has fractured recently into cultural and racial factions. Mm-hmm. The cultural one, best exemplified by Alain de Benoist and GRECE, and perhaps influenced by Francis Parker Yockey and his concept of race, has been relatively stagnant in recent years in regard to research and publications. On the other hand, the racialist faction, exemplified by Michael Mira and Guillaume Fay, mm-hmm. although appears to be ascendant. Can you enlighten us as to the state of these two factions and recent developments there?
Yes, you're quite right. Let me just underline an important thing, but I wouldn't like to go very much into details. There is unfortunately very much of a personal bickering as far as those two issues are concerned. They are not so much being debated on an intellectual level. It's rather a personal. I think it's probably a general disease among quote-unquote all right-wing or nationalist and nativist, or as they call them in French, identitaire, the identitarians, we can say, as opposed to communitarians, who are very much obsessed with their own ego. And anyway, this is just as a parenthesis. As far as those two concepts are concerned, they've been taken out of context very often. Yes, by all means, Alain de Benoist is giving much more, he's putting much more weight on this cultural approach and less on this biological determinism, as opposed to quote unquote the new fraction of new right, which is very much concerned, as everybody is in Europe, with the massive onslaught of foreign immigrants, and who are definitely, you know, not just biologically, but who are actually concerned for the survival of their race.
Our last submitted question is from James Bowery, a poster on majority rights, and it's a delightfully short question, and I encourage you to answer it at length. What should be the appeal of last resort before war in processing disputes over political boundaries?
Well, it really depends on how you define the war and what type of a war that is. I guess we've been sort of brainwashed, if I can put it that way, that wars are bad. Of course they are bad, but it depends how you define it. So I certainly would use war not the last form of resistance, but I would use it sometimes as the first form of resistance, if I'm reading it correctly, depending on my enemy, depending how he's going to approach me. If you could just enlarge it a little bit, I think I would be much more comfortable. At this stage, I can just put it bluntly. Yes, indeed, I think that wars are sometimes necessary. If you are fighting for your household, if you are fighting for that matter, for your ethnicity, or for that matter, for the survival of your culture, then you have to resort to some tangible means and some, well, let's call it some tangible weapons as well. You cannot desire.
And how much more should we be willing to resort to war if the stakes that we're dicing for are perhaps the survival of human beings or the biosphere itself?
Excellent. It's a good point. It just makes me think. It's just, you know, it got something in my head rolling. It just reminds me of a beautiful quote of my very dear Vilfredo Pareto, is a great sociologist, who said once, let me just quote him, let me try to paraphrase him a little bit. Whoever becomes a lamb will find a wolf to eat him. In other words, however much we can praise now multiculturalism, ecumenism, or what do you call it, this friendship, and this conviviality, this promiscuous pan-racial movement, this is all beautiful and good. I lived through that myself in a communist Yugoslavia. And the next day, the neighbors, next door neighbors, started whacking each other. So look, I'm pretty much realistic about those things. I don't want to scare you of your wits, but I'm not ruling that out in Chicago. I saw it firsthand in L.A. in 1992. I saw it, I heard about this in Cincinnati. So regardless how people can be nice and kind to each other, there comes a moment when even your next door neighbor will be happy to carve you up into pieces. You know, I saw it firsthand, so.
Oh, I think that in our neighborhood in Chicago, I seem to remember that I've encountered this.
Oh, yes. Well, I know.
I see.
And one thing which I'm truly, if you allow me, sir, and which I'm very much afraid of, that most folks are subconsciously, I'm not talking about academics, just general population, are aware of it. And everybody is just expecting some bubble or some miracle to happen, something that will prevent this from occurring. But this is just inexorably taking its place on a daily basis.
All right. Now, with your permission, let's plunge into the depths that I have planned for us,
mm-hmm.
shall we?
Please.
And we're going to look at, I have a passage here I want to discuss from page 128 of your first book, Against Democracy and Equality. And then there's a passage from your upcoming book, which we agreed to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
And they're related. The great concern for the new right is its deep-seated doubt in liberal capacity to stave off the irreversible demand for more equality. Given the contemporary dynamics of egalitarian discourse, it is likely that if economic opportunity or economic sources suddenly become scarce, total economic equality, and with it the rise of totalitarian democracy, may become the only viable alternative. Now that's very interesting. You say if things get scarce,
mm-hmm.
if the chairs begin to be taken away from the game of musical chairs,
mm-hmm.
that totalitarian democracy would be the form that people would flee to. And that's odd. I would think, well, anyway, please mm-hmm. talk about that.
Sure, by all means. Well, actually, let me just reverse the same statement that I wrote down quite some time ago. There is a nice piece by a gentleman, but also I'm quoting him in my upcoming book. Why did communism fall apart in the East? Well, this is not a joke, but it fell apart because many of its tenets had been fully implemented in the West. Many of those things that just for some reasons or other reasons that we can speculate about did not take root here in communist Yugoslavia, they took root. They, in fact, were quite successful in the liberal West. Equality, egalitarianism, equal rights, multiculturalism. Let me just, make a little digression. For instance, multiculturalism. We used it as a communist youth when I was a kid. We also talked constantly. We were obliged, we were in fact forced to talk about multiculturalism. We called it back then internationalism. So for some reasons, you know what happened in 1990, that particular experiment didn't work. It did work, however, in the United States of America. It still does work. It still does work in Western Europe. For how long, I can't tell you that. What I'm saying also, what I'm arguing, and I think I could provide some very good background story on that, is that at some point when those resources become scarce, be it oil or for that matter, if you wish, welfare state in England or for that matter, welfare state in Germany, I can guarantee you what I said earlier, that all those fancy friends who are now cozying up to each other will most likely start whacking each other.
Could you read the paragraph from your upcoming book that we discussed before? I just sent it to you by Skype chat, so you should have it right there to read. Could you read that out loud?
Yes, I have it here in front of me. It's pretty long. Do you want me to read it in the
Yes, Skype? Yes, I do.
Oh, I guess I'm... Just let me take my glasses and make sure. All right. So this is my book, Homo Americanus, the Child of the Postmodern Age, which should be out any week soon. And I'm grateful to some colleagues who helped me out, including Alain de Benoit, Gottfried, and many, many other guys. Let me just read it aloud. It is a serious failure to disregard communism as something historically redundant or as a temporary zigzag of history. Communism is the most logical form of perfect egalitarianism. It is a system which is dearest and nearest to the masses, no matter how dreadful its consequences can be for the masses. Communism is a system which flatters the animalistic impulses of each human being and brings out the worst behavioral elements in all individuals. However, communism is also an ideal social model for future mass societies facing shrinking natural resources and rapid modernization. After its official disintegration in the Soviet Union, the main feature of communism, such as the belief in progress and economic growth, have been brought to their perfection in the United States of America. In the decades to come, the role of Americanism, even if America splits up into smaller geographical entities, will continue to be dominant, regardless of the alleged withering of the state in the global world. In the case of an emergency, such a war, famine, terrorism, or some other unforeseen cataclysm, a future communized American mass society will be obliged to recur to manu militari, meaning military means, in order to preserve its stability. At that point, American elites, let's call them liberal elites, will cease to resort to verbal abstractions and acrobatics such as free market or individual human rights for all. In a perfect egalitarian system, citizens are designed to be expendable, since according to the canons of egalitarianism, everybody equals everyone. Thus, and this is what I'm underlining, thus, in order for the proper functioning of future Americanized society, the removal of millions of surplus citizens must become a social and possible, but also an ecological necessity. The result of such new social engineering will be visible in America and in Europe in the near future. This is end of the quote. I guess it was pretty explicit what I meant by that.
That's why I picked it. Stunning. I'm not even sure that I want to talk about it now. It was just great.
It does look a little bit... Well, actually, it's... Well, it's not wishful thinking. I hope this is not going to be the case. But what I'm basically, those who I'm blaming are not some Martians or, for that matter, bad communists. I'm blaming the liberal elites, who just self-centered and who live in their own world and who think that some miracles will happen.
Now I have a book here. I don't know if you've ever seen it. By William Gardner, The Trouble with Democracy, A Citizen Speaks Out. It's a pretty good book, recent. But he's an American right-wing Christian.
Uh-huh.
And he actually sees that there are flaws in what he calls modern hyper-democracy. But he traces them all back to the French Revolution.
Exactly. I fully agree with
and,
that.
But the new right thinkers carry that much farther.
Yes, exactly.
Because they trace the French Revolution itself back to Christianity.
Absolutely.
Because with Christianity, the introduction of Christianity into the West, all men became equal before God.
Mm-hmm.
Then with the American and French revolutions, all men become equal before the state. And then, of course, with the Boasian mm-hmm. and other related revolutions of the 20th century, everybody became factually, scientifically equal.
Yes.
Which
good point.
But this is what I got from your book.
Yes. Well, I certainly appreciate this gentleman. I've met literally dozens of conservative Christian intellectuals of great erudition, including my colleague, my mentor, Thomas Molnar. But I guess I have to say, in all modesty, we all do modesty, we are focusing on consequences of egalitarianism. If we want to go a step further, we have to backpedal a little bit into history. And therefore, I agree with Alain de Benoist, not just for some snobbish reasons, because he's more logic. He just traces back this idea of equality all the way back to Christianity. Afterwards, what we have in this 4th century, 6th century, and so on, is the progressive secularization of this idea of equality, which in the 19th, or actually late 18th century, during the American Revolution and the French Revolution, rebounded in a sense in the secular form of human rights and democracy. You know, human rights and democracy was the term which was first used during the American Revolution and then during the French Revolution, and then gradually just steamrolled in this religion of human rights and religion of democracy, which has become part of our daily reference, so to speak. I don't know if you can follow me on that. So yes, definitely.
Of course I can follow
but
you.
The problem is, and I have to say that in all modesty, and I just don't want to hurt some of your Christian conservative fellows, whom I greatly admire, by the way, but this is the problem. I call this a sort of a neurosis. Even in anti-Semitism is a form of a neurosis. how can, for that matter, if I can just enlarge it a little bit, just for a second, how can we talk about Jews, or for that matter, something, how can we hate somebody and yet at the same time venerate and cherish Bedouin dates, it's if you wish, a Levantine goddesses, and who are not mine. After all, Christianity is a Levantine religion, just like Islam. It's not a European religion. For that matter, why don't we read in American grammar school, or for that matter, high school, universities, more about Tacitus, or for that matter, antique scholars, or Seneca, for instance? I guess those folks need to be revived. So once again, if I can just make a clarification as far as the new right is concerned, this is not a ghetto. This is not some tribe. This is not some new age movement. New right is basically, in my view, a very wrong expression for a high erudite scholars who are dealing, who actually, or at least would like to resuscitate a little bit our heritage, which goes back not to Jesus Christ from Palestine, but which goes back thousands of years. And this is also part of our soil and part of our, how can I say, of our heritage, which we need to respect. I guess you'd probably agree with that.
Well, yeah, I probably would agree with that. I was thinking about Leo Strauss when you were talking. Mm-hmm. You know the Athens and Jerusalem thing Strauss
yes,
has?
It's a good dichotomy, yes, I know, but these are two...
Because what you're saying is a little more Athens, a little less Jerusalem, and I think maybe... I mean, obviously Strauss had a political reason for doing his whole Athens and Jerusalem thing, namely to taint and contaminate the Greeks mm-hmm. with Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I don't know. Do you have anything to say about Strauss?
Well, yes, of course, he's definitely a great scholar. There is no question about that. But whether you like it or not, well, even this, you know, that Strauss, after all, was alma mater, who was the mentor of the neocons here in Washington, D.C., or for that matter, in the East Coast. I always, when I read an author, for that matter, Strauss, I need to know exactly what his background is and what is his target. So I certainly see a sense of, how can I say it, he's much more focused as an alter ego of Jerusalem, as being the role model for the future Western society, and not Athens, for that matter, if you see what I'm saying. So basically, I know that for sure that in America he's sort of on the reading list, as opposed to other scholars like Vilfredo Pareto and Nietzsche, for that matter, who is just mentioned in passing.
Yeah, I'm interested in Pareto, and I was glad to read about him in your book.
But there are dozens of scholars like Gentile or Moscow or Michels, but great scholars, many of absolutely staggering erudition, who are not on the reading list in the United States of America. You can't find in those books.
No.
I mean, we are not talking about some weirdos. We are talking about true scholars. And hence the impression, especially in political science and humanity, especially when you read this literature, with Morgenthau, for that matter, with Kenneth Waltz in international affairs, or when you read, for instance, Leo Strauss and his books on philosophy. Actually, well, he made some good points, because this reductio ad Hitlerum, he was quite critical of, well, anyway.
Please, go on.
He made some very good comments, and he did, in a sense, Leo Strauss, he also made some good comments about this religion of anti-fascism, and he was against reducing all human experience to this quote-unquote fascism, anti-fascism. Hence the word that he coined, reductio ad Hitlerum, whereby modern scholars are trying to always, you know, reduce everything, all our social ills, to just one single issue, which is definitely wrong.
There's actually a law, I forget the name of it, but you can find it on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
There is a law which states that as the length of a discussion thread on the internet goes to infinity, the probability that someone will bring up Hitler rises to one.
Yes, yeah.
And also the corollary is at that moment the thread becomes impossible to carry on and you just have to stop.
Yes.
Start a new thread.
Absolutely. I fully agree with you. And if I can just make a sort of a pedagogical remark, if you allow me. I'm very much distressed, and this is not just in the States, so please don't have any second thoughts, or for that matter, complex of inferiorities. There are many, many stupid people here in Europe, and there are also many unread students, and let alone professors, while fighting for their tenures, and who barely ever read or translate something. So please, since you live across the sea for the time being, You should not, and your colleagues, you should not have any second thoughts, because I've met in America also good Native Americans of men of tremendous erudition. So, excuse me, go on.
Have you ever met Norman Lowell?
Yes, I know him well. We are good friends. Well, we're good colleagues.
Personally, you know
him? Yes, I know him.
You know him personally?
Personally, I know him. In fact, I was supposed to be now in Malta on the 27th of this month, but it's just running a little bit.
I would very much like to talk to him sometime. I have a question about him and his idea of the Imperium Europa, or as he says, Imperium Europa.
Yeah.
He actually calls for the establishment by 2012 of a nationalist, ethnic nationalist state in what is now Europe, called Imperium Europa. And he says that it will need a lingua franca, a common language. And he actually proposes Latin for this.
That's a very, that's an excellent suggestion on his part. Exactly. I know him well. That's what he, this is an excellent remark, but I see nothing wrong.
I would modify it. I would modify it. I would pick Esperanto rather than Latin, on the grounds that it's easier to learn, and that it was invented by a Jewish eye doctor and promulgated and is still promulgated as a means for universal one worldism, and I think and peace. And I think it would be actually amusing to adopt it for other purposes.
It's a good point that you made, and I'm perfectly aware of what you have just said. But this is precisely the reason why among European nationalists, I'm just taking a very large sense, not those ethnic nationalists, but just generally good Europeans, if you wish, rooted Europeans, Esperanto has never been welcome for the reasons that you mentioned earlier. They need a rooted language which evolves, like Latin. Latin, despite the fact that it has been archived, but it's nonetheless here. It has a great... In fact, the English language evolved from the Latin language. The French language evolved from the Latin language. The Italian language, all our syntax in Croatian and even in Russian, our Slavic language evolved from it. It's a beautiful language, so why not use it? Now, however, I see nothing wrong with the English language, especially the English language, not the American as phonetic English, which has been bastardized and barbarized by these Hollywood movies and so on. It's a beautiful language as well. It allows a certain word, phrasal verbs, which you don't have in other languages. So I don't have problems with...
Could you give an example of that?
You mean of phonetic, of phonetic American?
These phrasal verbs, you said.
Well, look, for instance, take the word make. Oh, gee, you can make in, make out, make up, make through. I mean, these are beautiful things which, of course, the Germans do not have this contextual phrasal verbs. They use prefixes and suffixes. The French also is a highly contextual language, full of homonyms and antonyms. So I hate to say that one language is better than the other. Sometimes I get personally, and this is truly off the record on a personal level, I get in a fierce fight with some of my European colleagues, who are men of great erudition, but who are not familiar with America, who are not familiar with... There is another side of America which needs to be cherished and which needs to be resuscitated even by Americans themselves. From Ezra Pound, Ambrose Bierce, you name it, Sinclair Lewis. Gee, they're beautiful authors over there. And I'm sorry. So basically,
I object to one thing. How can you mention Sinclair Lewis in the same breath as Ezra Pound and Ambrose
Bierce? Absolutely, I agree with you. Of course, you know.
Have you ever read Babbitt? I mean,
I
don't think Sinclair Lewis is. I think Sinclair Lewis is a terrible writer.
Yeah.
And the other two you mentioned are, of course, very good.
I know what you mean exactly, but I have to give credit even to authors whose political views I may not share, even to Hemingway, whom I not share, even to Kerouac, after all, you know, he was a hippie. So I fully agree with you, but in certain aspects, he may have seized Sinclair Lewis certain... What was this book where he mentioned, where he talks about those East Europeans from Estonia? Estonia was just a second. What was the name of the book? Where he talks about East Europeans in Chicago, exactly in Chicago, who worked in the meat industry. Was he published it in the early 20s? You will probably recall that book.
Wait. That was Upton Sinclair. That's not Sinclair Lewis.
Pardon?
Upton, you're thinking of Upton Sinclair.
Just a second. What did I mention? Was it?
You said Sinclair Lewis.
No, it was Upton Sinclair. Did I mention?
It was Upton. No, Upton Sinclair is okay.
Oh,
Sinclair.
No, I'm sorry. Not Sinclair. Upton Sinclair. I'm sorry about that.
Right.
Please apologize for that. Then.
But I have one other minor correction. Kerouac wasn't actually a hippie. He was a beat, and the hippies were actually... he disapproved of them in some ways. Mm-hmm. He was truly not a
hippie. Well, he died relatively. When was he died? In the late 50s, I guess. So he probably didn't have
a... No, I think he died like somewhere around 1970, but he was a terrible drunk.
I know that. But I guess he died somewhat earlier. Anyway, we're not going to dispute about that, but I read his Dharma Bums, and what was the other one? On the
Road.
Oh,
that's his best book. Dharma Bums is his best book, because if you remember, during most of it, the narrator is on a high mountaintop looking for forest fires from a little cabin, and he doesn't have any liquor.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? He's up there. So it's actually the best of the books, because he isn't drunk through most of the narration.
Oh, that's the problem also with European authors. They ruin themselves with wine. Exactly. Yes, well, basically, let me come back to the point. I see nothing wrong in the usage of the American language as a future lingo of United Europeans, be it from San Francisco all the way down to Moscow or Washington. There is nothing wrong with it, provided we keep it well cordoned off, and we keep it well formulated with good grammar. What I detest, and unfortunately I'm also the victim of it, is this phonetization of the English language, like this words. Instead of C-O-O-L, did you write K-O-O-L, like cool, or, you know, just...
Oh, and yeah, that's just internet slang.
It's the internet, but I think, well, I guess we all need it in a sense, but unfortunately even the words, the sentences are becoming more and more elliptic. When you read, for instance, okay, let me make it, I hope I'm not going to misquote, just a sec. You read, for instance, Carlyle. Of course, he has somewhat different, difficult lingo. When you compare his classical English to, let's say, to this modern English of Time Magazine, Newsweek, it's just like a day and a night difference. Who else can I think of? Lovecraft. Yes, he was a good American, and he has good sentence structures.
Interesting point about Lovecraft.
Yeah.
You find out other things about authors about prose when you read it out loud.
Yeah.
For instance, Conrad, even though Conrad wasn't a native speaker of English.
Oh, you mean this Polish guy, this Polish fellow, Conrad?
Joseph Conrad, can be read out loud. It's almost impossible for one's tongue to trip. The sentences roll from one's mouth in such a smooth, buttery fashion. It's perfect to read out loud. On the other hand, Lovecraft is nearly impossible to read out loud.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean,
good point.
It reads fine when you read it on the page, but I tried reading Lovecraft out loud to my daughter when she was little to see if I could give her bad dreams, and it's very difficult. I read her, I think, A Night in the Witch House.
Thanks for telling me that. I haven't thought about it. Thanks. It's a very good remark, and it's a good, because I sometimes like reading aloud and see how it sounds. Good point, indeed. No, I like that. You know, it's because you know what the sentences are of Lovecraft, and it's quite, you know, it's a very philosophical prose.
Oh, I love Lovecraft, but I can't read it out loud.
Exactly. No, it's a good point you made. Yes. Anyway, America. Yes.
Well, let's talk about literature the next time I have you on the show. Thank you very much, Dr. Sunik, and we look forward to talking with you again.
That's very kind of you, sir, and I am at your service, and do send my best regards to your colleagues, and tell them that I'm always at their service for our cause.